Blog Talk Radio.
We're going to do this this song by John Martin. Scottish folk singer, rock and roll type of guy. It's called Over the Hill.
Going away to leave you, I'm gonna leave you in disgrace. Nothing in my favor, got the wind in my face. I'm going home. Hey, 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 over the hill. Over the hill. Hey, 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 over the hill. Can't get enough of sweet cocaine, get enough of a Mary Jane. Going back to where I come from, I'm gonna roll it back home again. Over the hill. Hey, 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 over the hill. Over the hill. Hey, 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 over the hill. Just one place for a man to be when he's worried about his life. I'm going home. Hey, 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 over the hill. Well, over the hill. Hey, 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 over the hill. I'm going away to leave you, gonna leave you in disgrace. Got nothing in my favor, got the rain in my face. I'm going home. Hey, 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 over the hill. Well, over the hill. Hey, 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 over the hill.
Well, that was, well, hey, it's not stopping.
Thank you. We'd like to play a new song. We're going to do this,
Well, that was, Over the Hill, a John Martin cover by Chris Robinson. Anyways, so this is Your Mother's Medicine Cabinet on a Monday night. And I'm just going to bring on the, we're turning the tables. I have some books coming out, so we're going to have Jeffrey Santolo interview, do the other way around. It's going to be strange. All right, later. You're on.
Hi, Frank. Hi, Frank. Hey. How you doing? Thanks, first of all, thanks for the honor. Yeah, it's a great honor to interview you. Kind of postmodern, the caller interviewing the host. I like it.
Well, I've seen that done over before with the Epic Rights people. They've done that before, and I've got some stuff coming out, so I didn't have a guest because my guest guy just dropped off the face of the earth, so I just took the spot.
Oh, no, it's a great honor. For those who don't know, Frank's new book's coming out this fall, The Nirvana Haymaker, from Neopoiesis Press. I believe that's New Making, right? Greek, right? Can you tell us a little bit something about that press, Frank?
Well, it's run by Dale Winslow, and she's the editor-in-chief out there in Vancouver area. And it originally started with like four people and four different, two people in America, one in England, and Dale in Canada. And I think now it's like a couple of people in Canada or maybe somebody in America or just Dale. But I know there's people that help her out and work with her. So, they've published like myself and Will Crawford and Sam Ledger and Jeanette Kazantzakis. I can never say her last name. And but she's a fantastic writer. And Neil McRae. And they also like got some, they're going at like part of their, they got a division that's like working on like textbooks or something. And there's another like, they publish like some like Neil McClellan, philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
Passed away, I guess, but his son, I guess. They published something of his, a philosophy book, and they kind of do like all kinds of stuff, I guess. Started out as a poetry press, but, they've expanded.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. And it's coming out this fall, so it should be shortly. Look forward to it. I know I've read a lot of it here, and some really, really great stuff. And do you care to start off with the reading? I want to get in as much as we can here. Is there a particular one you'd like to read off the bat here first, Frank?
Let me see. I've got the one that you had sent me. I mean, that I had sent you.
Yeah.
Kind of like the it's the kind of the one I send to anybody that's doing reviews or I mean, there's much more to the book. There's like 200 pages. Of course, I sent you like 25 of each book. We'll talk about the other book later. But I kind of like try to I've been reading kind of the same ones because I'm trying to like save some. So. I'm going to start off with a long one, and it's a narrative piece, and it's called 10 Years. And this was going to be in the Lummix review that's coming out in November, but they had to switch poems. Like, they're taking another one I'm going to read later, but it's just a long one. Okay. If I could explain 10 years any better to you, I would. But the rubber to the road gave the fingers a notion to the heart that pounds the machine and holds the bottle. 10 years never had anything profound to say. It never understood how to say goodbye properly or how to age with birthdays. Its soul had always been found in the silence of every moving bus window of every town that had already left. 10 years was the Christmas card mailed without a reply. It was every religious sentiment seen on a big sign outside Greenville and Fort Worth, while the mouth chomped on another fried meal that had been wrapped up by 3 days ago. 10 years turned the loving man into the cautious man, into the person who sees the world in between love and hate, the kind of person that only a payphone could stand talking with. 10 years translated old country and blues songs into the veins of every footstep and thumb that stabbed the atmosphere when looking for a ride. 10 years was a $20 bill hanging out of the thong of every strip club. It was a $2 whiskey it had bought for every dancer named Maggie while she brushed her perfumed pussy onto its thigh. It was the hole in the wall after a night of drinking and fighting with one of the many girls it had moved in with after knowing them for only two beers. And that hole was deep, so deep that it could see the next 10 years as it charged out like a midnight freight train. 10 years was smoking cigarette after cigarette from the flamingo pink banister of a $125 a week hotel after it had borrowed the money to pay for it from a distant relative who had already given up. 10 years traded stories with people in the check cashing line while they both sweated and twitched out the disbelief of this is it with Hall of Fame lines in their face. 10 years was made out of cardboard silver ashtrays that showed the partial blur of its face. It was made out of tiny plastic Dixie cups on the sink of its hotel room, where the water had the bitter taste of sulfur blanketed in lonely nights. 10 years healed its wounds with poem and unnecessary hope. Hope was never a good friend to 10 years. In fact, hope had stabbed 10 years when it had just started out and then took off with promise as 10 years lay bleeding in the gutters of the world. 10 years had always been on the loose and never had anything to lose. It never had felt at home, but even in the worst of times, even when tomorrow felt like a constant set of todays and delusions, 10 years kept burning. It kept fighting the empty spaces and the endless miles. 10 years always kept shouting love to every piece of dust that fell from every ceiling fan's repetitive heartbeat. And it survived so long only because it learned quickly how to light up every room when it inhaled the burning red cherry that had always glowed deeply inside the darkness of its chest.
Wow. That's great. That's nice. I love the disbelief of this is it. When tomorrow felt like a constant set of todays. Wow. I mean, that's just, it's just really great.
Yeah.
I love the repetitive nature.
Yeah, it was kind of like, I remembered after like, a month or two after the 9/11, that I had moved down south, and I had lived in the Boston area for 28 years. Of course, I've traveled out, but I lived there for 28 years. And then, like in 2001, I moved south, and shortly after I had a brand new child and a southern wife and going a short shotgun wedding, and it didn't last, you know. And then after the messy divorce, I just went out on the road for so many years, living off Greyhound buses and crashing on people's couches, living a month here, living a month there, up until about halfway through of 2009. I did that for like years, and the loneliness of the road can get to you. So like, that's kind of like what it seemed like. I kind of like encompassed it all that time into one thing instead of like writing about one specific event.
Yeah, you translated the pain into beauty, man. That's the alchemy of poetry. Nice job, man. That was really, really well done. You're really prolific. I wanted to ask you, if I could, your approach to writing, or regimen to it. Do you have a strict regimen you follow, or is it, do you go more just by the feel? And how do you work, per se?
Well, it's sort of changed over the years. It's taken different tones. There used to be a time where I only wrote with paper. And then, of course, like, I don't know, like seven or eight years ago, I finally decided to get with the times and get the internet, you know. And I started writing by computer. And now I can't write any other way, like, other than with a keyboard. I just recently, with my trips to the woods, because I've been wanting to, like, write, like, poetry that's happening in the moment, you know, like, I've been practicing that observational kind of stuff, and so I've been bringing a little notebook with me, but I don't bring it anywhere else but to the woods. I don't, like, go to the store with it and stuff, but every morning, usually every morning I write. And it's not because, like, I'm regimented to do it. It's just when it happens. Because, you know, I wake up with either a burst of energy or I wake up anxious and I brew that coffee. And as soon as I, like, you know, I don't drink coffee but in the morning. But as soon as I, like, take that first sip or two, like, I just start writing. And sometimes it will last an hour. Sometimes it will last 6 hours, you know. Or sometimes it will last 2 hours and then 2 hours later. You know, but it's usually at least every morning, you know, whatever that time may be.
Yeah, that's great. And so now you're getting more into you find your poetry moving in towards an observational kind of almost zen-like, I would say, you know, kind of that.
Well, yeah, that
Satori. I'm sorry.
I started playing around with that in this book, The Nirvana Haymaker, which is much more narrative. I mean, there's some language poems in there, but it's much more narrative, and the poems are getting smaller, and and in the next book that will be out next year, I'd say half the book is short poems, like, and there's probably only two or three poems that will be on a page or two. And but it's just it's what I've been observing lately. Like, you know, you try to find like your peace, because up until like 6 months ago, I was like locked in a basement, one bedroom apartment in a basement for like almost 2 years. I didn't leave my house. Like, you know, I went crazy. So needless to say, but I didn't leave for like a year to 2 years. And then as I started getting better, you know, feeling better in the head, I just started leaving the house, you know, and there's nowhere to go in this town. So I like would keep walking to this like nature park, you know, and it just started, that came from there. But and I'll read some of those like the second half of the show. But, you know.
Yeah. If I could make a request, I mean, I have like 10
okay.
of them.
Go ahead.
Kind of. It's a little bit to that kind of, this one really moved me out. Empty-handed and losing time at the poker table of plots.
Okay, I got to scroll down on my thing here. Yeah, that's, those poems were kind of like, these were the start of the observational poems when I was still locked up in the house. And anyways, I'll explain it after. Empty-handed and losing time at the poker table of twats. All the big shots of the world who carry guns could never understand the battle cry that comes from a silent piece of wind carrying wilted flowers from my mantle all the way to the ground. I had this table across that has like sometimes has these like dying flowers that we both in this house seem to ignore, and for some reason like this. I wrote about it several times, you know, or in titles or in poems about these flowers. And, like, every time we changed them, they would just stay and be left to die again. And it just became this reminder to me, you know, while I was going through my own anxieties and battle with depression, you know. And I used to become a news junkie, you know, political junkie. And back at this time when I was locked in the house, I was like watching a lot of news and watching a lot of sports and writing. I was doing nothing else. And I gave up on the news, but I remember I would see all these like terrible things like guns and armies and et cetera, et cetera. But then they went to just can't understand like the beauty that falls from a dying leaf. Like, you know, your time's coming soon, basically.
Yeah. No, you nailed it. I mean, that's perfect. I mean, you go from the big shot all the way down to the flowers to the ground. I mean, that's a really powerful, powerful poem. I love that one. Love that. I hate to ask this question, but I kind of have to. Influences. I mean.
Yeah, I can. My influence is extremely wide. When I started out, you know, I'm not going to go into a huge story about it, but when I started out, like, in college, I studied philosophy mostly in history because I couldn't handle what they were teaching for literature for the most part in school. I thought it was dull, drab, and boring. I tried to get into the Chaucers and the stuff like that. I can't do it. It makes me want to put a bullet in my head. And same with Billy Collins and those guys. But, you know, I eventually got turned on to the Beats and Kerouac, and I was really into Burroughs the most at first, you know. And following Burroughs, I discovered Louis Saline, who I still believe wrote the greatest novel of all time. And then through him, I kind of went backwards, and I discovered, you know, like Bukowski, and, you know, and then there was Kerouac. And then my poetry from my first book, Interstate Chokehold, is kind of like very choppy, and it's like you can tell it's like a very like it's a young writer trying to find his voice, you know, and I just, you know, it just went from there, and I just started reading more poetry per se, especially I'd always read it, but I got really deep into it when I was locked up in here for 2 years, because that was the other thing I did, was constantly read and reread the stuff I read 10 years ago and reread the new stuff. But now it's probably like, you know, on rotation, it's still Kerouac, it's still Bukowski, but also there's Jeffers and there's Lee Poe and Ms. Basho, and of course there's like the people I admire that are around now, like Dorsey and Gerald Loughlin and Rob Plath and Will Crawford and Rebecca Shimada, and there's just all kinds of people, April Bratton, and there's all kinds of, you know, the list keeps expanding, but I do have my favorites, you know.
Because I know you have some allusions to Lee Poe, of course, and Hart Crane was,
Hart Crane. I have to be in the mood for Hart Crane, though. Sometimes I want to be like, why? And then the other times I'll really like it, like, you know. So
I know. The Bridges are tough read. It really is.
It's I have to be in that mind frame. It's the same with, like, with Berryman's Dream Songs. As much as I love Berryman, I have to be in that mind frame to read it.
Absolutely.
You know, so.
Now, that's a nice segue because...
You want me to read the big one, don't you? You want me to read the Suspension Bridge one, don't you? Okay.
Endless sky.
All right, I'll read it. Hold on, I got to take a sip of water. All right. The endless sky above the suspension bridge. Let us break our necks. Hold on. I have to restart that because I've scrolled wrong. Let us break our necks. Let us break our necks or at least write a Japanese death poem. But let us not be the lightning lying helplessly, for it's nice to look up from the ground at bridges. Or, so a ravaged doll once said, it feels impulsive, and impulsive carries a lot of weight, more weight than myself. We should like how it feels when embankments absorb us with their thickets of cold muck and endless hours of calm but comfortable boredom. Up high as the broken bones can see, I know that there are long-lost kingdoms inside the cables of a suspension bridge. The ones from the other side of the sky told me so, and the gods have become jealous of my gaze, especially Apollo, because he cannot understand why the sun is so fixated with my pale face. Neither do I. It is wet, grimy, and it is missing its strange voice that was lent to me by my father's depression and alcoholism. Such is the song of all that has passed. I'm solemn here and utterly for the taking. Soon I expect the city to take me away, far away into their lonely histories. They'll perform a ceremony or two. Someone will light a candle and whisper something profound. They'll comb my beard and drain my blood. Such is the song. Such is the dullness of boring men and their soundless pity. The answer to your question won't be found here. I like your urgency too much to give it to you that easily. But if it was not for your inquiry, I probably would have not found peace. Peace and bodily fresh spasms and tortured swelling. But I have often wondered, if I did give it to you, would your mouth become pregnant with charming and sensitive mercies? Would you try to turn beauty into something contrived with marketability? Oh, how Basho must have felt when his family moved into his hut and asked him so many questions. Teacher's guilt is hell. Oh, never mind. I like to watch the cars up on the bridge, the trucks, bikers, and walkers. Where are they going? Can they see me at all? Do they notice the goodness in particulars around me? Do they see the angels with their checklists and instructions? Can they see the Mississippi and its hopelessly romantic river weeds reach from the fog like an old river devil stealing my hanging ribs? There's so much they don't know here in this infinite hurry. Oh, how I love to know that I can feel the blaze in between with its glorious colors and stillness of perfect melody. Let us be our own realities and live in them so tightly that not even the wind from a shitty epitaph could find us. Let it sound so indecent that it would make the sheets of St. Malay blush. And like all afternoons down at the bottom of velocity, I dare mention the story my friend from the wilderness told me. They said, if you drop a penny off the Empire State Building, it would gather so much speed that it would crack the sidewalk or blast a hole the size of a moon crater into someone's head. I was always amazed by that, and I often wondered if beautiful Edens and marvelous poetry would finally seep out of their holes in their heads. I wonder if the travesty of crap that disarms an ordinary man's life would pour from their holes like an unstable magma, like an uncontrollable fire with a burly chest that is finally pushing them around after being trapped for so long. And as I lay here in intricate and different shapes, unlike my former shapes of marrow, blood, saliva, and bone, gasping the last of this earth and fuel, I'm inclined to believe it.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that's just, every line is perfect. Nice job. Wow.
Yeah, that was quickly. It was just inspired by, I couldn't think of something to write that day. And I was reading about, for some reason, I read about Berryman's suicide, or I watched a video or something like that. And then, like, I was brought, you know, how he jumped off a bridge, and I was brought back to this place in Decatur, Alabama, that I used to like to lie in this park next to this river, and it had this big, huge cable suspension next to this Mississippi River. I used to just lay there on the grass next to the river and just watch the people up on the thing, because I just did, and I kind of brought me back to that time.
I mean, let us be our own realities and live in them so tightly. I mean, that should be a mantra for poetry today. I mean, that's a great, great line. Let us be our own realities and live in them so tightly. Yeah, I love it. That's a great work. It's nicely, nicely done. I know I always ask this question when I call in.
Am I right in forms?
Experimenting in forms at all? Anything?
No, not really. I sometimes will play around with a haiku once in a while, but like every time I start to try to like write in forms, I just get like overrun with something else, and I want to do the other thing. I have too much. I'm at this junction in my life where there's at 38. There seems to be like all this like. For some reason, all this, like, wisdom and all this, like, life-changing stuff that's happening in my head that needs to come out, and I have no time for form right now. Like, you know, and if that could change in a few years, it could change in 10 years, it might never. But I was always a fan, when the spirit wanes, the form appears, or when the form appears, when the spirit wanes, the form will appear. I've always liked that line from Charles Bukowski, and, I kind of feel that when I'm writing, trying to write a sonnet or something of that nature, that I'm not like, I'm losing the reason why I should be writing in the first place. That's just how I feel right now. I don't know if that will change.
Yeah, I agree. I think form, form's a double-edged sword. I mean, it's constricting, especially when that inspiration's just coming out and it's just flowing and flowing and flowing. I mean, you don't want to stop there and sit there, okay, do I need to, shape it this way or what have you. The flip side to it is that with the constraint, it can, tighten the piece, tighten the vision, tighten the message. But it's a fine line, and I agree. If the juices are flowing, there's no reason to stop them. I mean, just let them fly. I like the experiments and forms, personally, like a Berrigan with sonnets, etc.
Well, that one I just read to you is the long lines, and it's like two pages of long lines, and I probably wrote that in like 20 minutes. Like, if I was trying to play around with form, I would have missed that entire poem.
Exactly.
The poem might have taken 20 minutes, but then like I'm the world's worst speller, so then that takes like 3 more hours, but I'm going to switch it since there's, let me see here on the switchboard, we're 30 minutes, so I'm going to switch it to the other book for a few minutes. It's now that I'm looking at what I sent you, it says untitled, but it's now called Blood Music. It's coming from Punk Hostage,
I got a request from that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, which one?
It will come out of nowhere like a gunshot.
Okay, hold on, let me screw them. But yeah, it's they're out of LA, run by Razor and Iris Berry, and Razor's an old friend for the past like 4 or 5 years, and he asked if I had anything going on, and there's so much, they're doing so much at Neo Places. Like Dale always said she would publish my stuff, but it would have been 2 years and I had so much material that was pouring out of me at the time. I didn't want to sit on it for 2 years, so I'm giving it to them. I'm about 20 or 30 pages done from finishing it, but this one is, and that will come out, I don't know, first half of next year sometime. It will come out of nowhere like a gunshot. Turning the bends of the trail, walking the ups and downs, the bees in front of me are just bees. The hanging limbs of the trees are touching nothing. The sweat on my neck is only sweat. The flowers are red, yellow, and purple. They stand only because of their roots in the active soil. The wild turkey runs away from me because it is a turkey. The duck slaps his feathers against the emptiness of the water. And when the trail turns into the park with its screaming children and disheveled-looking parents, my shoulders grow tight, my head becomes dizzy. I keep walking through everything but nothing, reminding myself of a line from the Diamond Sutra. Even the words to enlightenment are merely words. Feet move on, the trail is still a trail, the trail is still only a trail, and the thoughts of my mind are just thoughts. I don't like the scattering of birds after a gunshot.
Nicely done.
Sometimes things like that.
What? Paul, I was just going to ask, did we have any callers on the other line? Anybody calling in?
Yeah, no. But anybody can call in. I don't know. But if they don't, then they don't. it's not a big deal. That poem is just this park that I go to every day, half of it's woods and half of it's a park, and it's got like a walking trail that I try to keep off of now, and because there's too many people. And I like to test myself around people once in a while, so I leave the woods and I start walking around them, and I have like a lot of problems with being around people. Like, you know, not like that I hate them, I prefer to be quiet.
I think all artists are that way. I mean, you know, there'll be levels of anxiety, there'll be levels of depression. That's where great art's formed from, because you have to be a sensitive soul to really write to affect people. You know, no matter how tough the exterior, I mean, Jack Kerouac, great football player, you know, sensitive soul, you know. And you can only be that way when to write successfully. You have to be that way. And that's why so many writers are that way. They're misperceived as being, oh, they don't like people or what have you. But they're shy, they're sensitive, they have, you know, depression or anxiety or whatever the case may be. You know, I'm not a psychologist or anything.
Yeah, that's for many years, without getting much into it, so we don't waste too much time on that subject, but I was like a... many years into like a lot of pills and a lot of alcohol and a lot of like, I mean, whatever gave me the balls of Clint Eastwood to be like, you know, among people. But now, like, you know, I drink beer once a week, like, you know, if that, you know, and I was just coming out of this like cocoon of nothingness or something, and realizing all this life in front of you, and hopefully one day I'll be able to move on to people. But I'm going to read this one poem from that collection. It might sum it up a bit. It's called It Has Been a Year or Two. It has been a year or two now of weekly walks through the park to get to my shrink's office, where I no longer take it upon myself to drink for all the different voices and personas that have been jamming up my head. All those many years completely unaware and drunk 7 days a week, finally whittled down to one voice, one human, one pair of hiking boots. And with each step that I continue to take, I can finally taste the flowers and the wind. I can finally bring together silence's two giant iron hands, wrap them around my head, and juice out every last voice with my tears.
Yeah, that's great. That is good. That was It Has Been a Year or Two. Oh, that was good. Great stuff, Frank.
Yeah. But not in your collection. Hold on, that's from there, because I wrote it after I'd made that thing. Hold on a second, let me find it here. Yeah, it's a longer one, and this is the last long one I'm going to read, so if you pick anyone else after,
okay.
Make it a decent size one. Hold on, I'm just going to have to do a search here. It'll bring it up for me. Here we go. All right. This one is for any man in the world who's gone through fucking divorce. It's called 5 foot one, 5'1" and shitting railroad tracks. At 5'1", you drank more than anyone I had ever seen. You turned that bottle of Heaven Hill whiskey upside down with massive gulps until it was gone. Myself in the corner scribbling secret notes and playing music. You liked it when I wrote. You never wanted to hear any of the poems, but my madness coming out on paper in between sips of beer somehow calmed you down. That was before you put my face into the dashboard with that head-on collision on Slaughter Road. Before your weekly religious conversions, before the mind games and jealous trickery. Those days in the trailer when we only had 2 nickels to rub together for bread, when I had to walk 3 miles to work because we drank the gas money, when you slept till 4 p.m. with a hangover as I wrote in the other room with black coffee and my own hangover that felt like 2 metal pans slapping against my head. Those were the days of passion and reality. Those were the times when I could count on something happening and anything to keep the fires burning. When I think of all the madness that I endured while trying to find my voice, while working at the Coke plant, while dealing with all your rabbit punches, I am reminded of how thick my skin was, how much I was made of iron. Nowadays, it shrinks, walks in the parks, and observing the birds. And yes, it is necessary now, but my confidence was unbreakable back then, unshakable. You used to tell me that I owned any room that I stood in, that my head was always high, and even if a man knocked me down, he still lost the fight. I pissed nails and shit railroad tracks, you'd say. And I'd often felt that way, even after your religious conversion, even after the divorce. I felt that way when I lived on Greyhound buses inside the dark bars of Kansas City, Decatur County, and West Warwick. When I was camping in abandoned houses, the seedy hotels, and the loose women who claimed to like what I wrote but never understood a line of it. It only made me stronger when you get so drunk and punch me, and with each black eye and with each cut or bloody nose, I believed in the world even more. It made me realize with all the writing was that all the writing was the right thing to do when you dressed the wounds upon my face. I saw it all before me, there for the taking, when you put a cold beer on my eyes, you slowly blew your liquor breath onto the scabs that had already formed. But this was all before you found some god while picking up beer bottles from under the bed, until I came home from work and noticed that all my books were in the trash, until you began to punch me for all the wrong reasons, like not mowing the grass and for drinking on Sunday. The magic had ended when I crossed the T's and on the divorce papers. All those hard nights and beer-soaked days were down the toilet. All that class and reality you once had gone within seconds, like a side of beef tossed to the dogs. And with that Jesus shirt you wore, you told me that I was shit, and for a few years I was. You told me that I was doomed to fail, that I'd be nothing, and for a few years I was. But it all began to make sense during all those hateful nights with all those women with vaginal warts inside the vacant hotels of my heart. Now, there are books, 5, 10, 25, 100 sold. Now there are readings and radio shows and delusional nights by my machine. And sometimes I think of you when I write, how at 5'1", with your bottle in hand, how you gave me your special gift. And I still have it, and I'll use it when no one is looking, because an isolated rage that powerful and a fire that wild that burns that out of control should never be in the hands of a novice.
Should never be in the hands of a novice. You see? Alchemy. Alchemy.
Yeah. Well, you got to take, like, you know, that was like an insane time in my life. So, like, I ended up writing that one about it. And, you know, I had written poems about these situations with, like, her before. And then I was just able to finally get it out in the way I wanted to get it out. And I really liked it. And that one will be in Blood Music.
Yeah.
But, see, we have 21 minutes, so you'll have to ask the questions, and if you request poems, they must be a page and a half. No, I'm losing my breath on the poem.
Yeah, you've done some marathon pieces, so we'll keep them short. I like Ask the Studios, really good one.
Give me a breath for a second. So, you got any questions? I need to rest my voice.
Yeah, okay. Let's, when did you? When did you start to? It's kind of a tough question to ask anybody, and it's a little bit unfair of me to do so. But what the heck? I'm going to go for it. We write usually because we have to write. When did you start writing?
Okay. Well, see, I was born in, like, 74, so when I was a kid, like, cable was just, like, coming out and all that stuff, and we didn't, I lived with my grandparents most of the time because my dad traveled for work and I didn't know my mom, so they didn't go out and buy Atari or nothing like that. So I was either out in the woods with sticks playing, you know, fake army, or I was in my room reading books and listening to 45 records. And I had no musical talent whatsoever. So after, like, reading books like the, you know, the Hardy Boys and stuff like that that I read when I was a kid, I just started writing short stories when I was little, and I was terrible, but I loved doing it. What I liked the most was creating my own characters, but I didn't, like, stick with it. But when I had, like, writing assignments in school, like, you know, like, write a theme for this page, and I would write, like, 5 or 6 pages on, like, some, like, little detective story or something. But, you know, then college came, and I just started, like, studying philosophy, smoking a lot of pot, tripping out, and trying to, like, bag chicks. Like, that's basically what I was doing. And I just, you know, I just gave up writing.
We all were.
Yeah, and I just, like, gave up writing. And somewhere in my mid-20s, late-20s, I picked it up all the time. And, you know, and I started really writing when I was out on the road for 10 years. That's why, like, the first book that I have out, which, like, you know, some people really like and some don't, you know, which is fine. That's anybody. But I just, it's got a lot of, like word pairings and things thrown together that shouldn't be there. And, you know, and it's got other things. Like, it's got some narrative ones, but I didn't have a voice yet, you know. It's kind of like the best poems I could pull together for X amount of time. But that's what I was writing all the time. You know, that's what I started all the time. And but when I got here, and I just, like, stopped being on the road for, like, so long. I had nothing I could do in this little town. So I started writing constantly. And it just became what these books that we're reading has come out of that 3 years of constant writing, like, hours upon hours a day. And now I can't live without it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you write because you have to write. And you hit upon a big thing. I mean, to be a good writer, you have to be a great reader, too, you know. And, you know, because for all the originality that we strive for, you know, we're all building our ideas off of, you know, ideas that have come before. We have a palette of emotions that we can work with, but, you know, basically that's what we have. I'm sorry, go ahead. You want to say something?
No, it's totally true. I mean, like, a lot of people, like, say Bukowski now, and he borrowed completely from Hampson, Fonte, Celine, and in other words, like, people love Kerouac, he completely borrowed from Jack London. There was just, it's just a lineage that goes throughout, you know, try to write on the road again, like, you know, it's been done. I mean, you could write your own travel story, but don't make it like someone else's.
Exactly, it's all about style and voice. You know,
if we stick to our own stories, if we tell our own stories, whether it be prose or poems, the originals, you stick to your own stories, you know.
Well, being a fellow Massachusetts boy, well, I'm sorry, I cut you off there.
Go ahead. No, I was done.
I was going to ask you to read The Unmovable Fragrance for Kerouac. We're both from Massachusetts. We both know lovely Lowell, Massachusetts, hometown to the great Jack Kerouac.
Hold on, I gotta scroll down. Oh yeah, this language book, more or less. But yeah, lovely Lowell, you put it so kindly.
Yeah,
I don't know. Oh yeah, I just found it. Yeah, I just went through this phase where I wrote like 6 or 8 poems for, like, writers that I admired. And there was, like, Kerouac, and there's one for Creeley, and there's one for Celine, and there's one. There's a few of them. Carson McCullers. But anyways. Troubled by wine, unaware of the darkening skies that pour down from the highways of nightmare lands, with consciousness fermenting and traces of moonlight's footsteps, you would bark as a mad dog, looking for the simple and the blessed that lived as fragrance floating within the strange truths, that dressed in the temples of empty skies, you would banish these immortal gods, stripping them down to the plain lotus, sucking them into the unmovable void, chanting with words of twinkling stars, exploding viciously into unseen ending, locating the core of silence, and then, with a river of wind, laughter.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, I like to play with language sometimes. I just, I don't do it as much, you know, because sometimes you can come off as a pompous prick, like, you know, or it will, you know, or it'll just sound like a windbag. Like, after a while, it's just like, when is this freaking poem going to stop, you know?
Right. You get too clever. Yeah, exactly. I know. That's a problem of being too clever. You know, it's sometimes you got to go for the emotion, not the cleverness. I have that problem. I try to be too cute sometimes, and, you know, it gets to be too show-offy. But that one's great, Frank.
Thanks.
Heavy in Dirt? Heavy in the Dirt?
Heavy in the Dirt. Okay, let me see. Oh, here it is. Yeah, this one I wrote right after a hiking trip to the Badlands that me and my girlfriend took last June. It's called Heavy in the Dirt. As the hiking boots finally learn to bend more than the spine of a book, I, too, will not look into the eyes of man until the ego goes blind. That is sort of a little bit of a middle finger to the bookworms of the world once in a while as I sit here around, like, towers of books. But I just, like, sometimes I just wonder, you know, if other people live any kind of life, you know, or if they ever talk about anything else. I make a point to do other things. Like, you know, I make a point to live life. You know, whether it's watching a football game or whether it's, you know, walking in a park or whatever it is I might do, meditate, freaking drink a beer, whatever it is, like, I make it a point to live my life. That is kind of like me kind of saying, like, you know, these boots are bending now, so fuck the spine of the book. Like, you know, I've had enough of it. You know, it's not that I'm done reading. I just, you know.
Yeah. No, it's bringing the poetic moments of every day to the reality. I mean, more than the written word. I mean, I think it was Octavia Paz, the great Mexican writer, who said that we should be living poetically in moments and not writing it. You know, that's where he thought the new level for poetry should be, is that we should strive to start living it. And I've always found that inspiring, and I find that to be intriguing.
Yeah, no, it can also, like, yeah, it's inspiring because I know what it means. I understand what it means, but there's also, then there's, like, the annoyance of it all. Like, people that want to, like, shove damn poetry down my throat 24 hours a day, like, you know, or... If you know, then this is the Renaissance Fair people, like, you know, with their poetry all day, or, like, you know, let's dress up as Edgar Allan Poe and recite Edgar Allan Poe with a strange accent, like,
I get you there. No, I meant more more sublimely than that. I meant living poetically, not acting poetically.
Yeah.
But another great one here. At Vesuvius.
Okay. See, I just had that one, too.
I think I
asked you
to read that one.
Yeah, hold on. I'm just going to scroll up. Yeah. All right. At Vesuvius, if there was ever a moment, ever a time, when we began cutting away at the barbed wire surrounding the heart, it was after we ordered our first drink. Was after we learned to speak from the shady side of our limbs. That was that just inspired by sitting in Vesuvius last July in San Francisco with Paul Coleman Roberts and then Alexander and Brian Fouget and all those people. And we did, like, the week-long poetry festival in Oakland with all kinds of different readings with hundreds of writers and stuff. It was pretty cool. I'd never been to Vesuvius before or City Lights, so... You know, it was kind of inspiring to be there.
Great, great group of talent right there. You just named some great names there. I love that. The shady side of the ribs. That's perfect. That's great.
Yeah, I was a lot of quiet the first few days there, you know, and but then once we, like, you know, started having a couple of beers, sitting in Vesuvio's, and that jazz was playing, and we just all got in a conversation. We all were getting buzzed, and, you know, that shady side of our ribs, like, you know, speaking from the heart, man, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I know we must be getting close to the end here, so I'm going to get to the big question that I love to kind of ask all the time when I call in and all the time. But poetry, future of it, where do you see it going, new directions, I mean the internet, all your thoughts and feelings on these subjects?
Well, I'll start with the internet one, because that's the one I ask all the time. But my personal belief on the internet is, one, the talent pool does get diluted, but at the same side, that's a double-edged sword to say, because there was a time when I wasn't writing good, and there isn't at all, like, you know, and even now half the time I'm writing crap. But, you know, these people, it's hard to say, like, if they're, like, you know, I believe in bad writing, of course I do, but at the same time, if you're talking on the emotional side of it, I'm not about to be the type of person that shit stomps on people's fucking feelings anymore. But, you know, it's up to them to become a better writer. You know, it's not up to me to point that out, you know. So, yeah, I do believe the talent pool is diluted, but yet sometimes people don't want to be writers. They just want to share something they like to do. It is a good tool to meet people. It is a good tool to find readings because, face it, people don't have the money to make up the same amount of magazines they did in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s. So, like, people were always constantly together, and there was always these magazines or things being handed out or always words and stuff or gatherings of people. Like, you can't travel anymore. You can't freaking hitchhike without the cops bothering you. You can't jump on a train anymore unless you want to get beat to death by the union train workers. They don't have freaking boats really that much unless you want to take a cruise ship to Europe. So there's no way to really travel around a lot of times. So the internet really does provide a way to say there's a reading in a month. Can you get here? So, yeah, it's got that. At the same time, you know, if you want to deal with the sifting through bad writing, deal with some dramatic things, like, you know, I've been around it long enough now to know that, like, I just don't go on it if I don't want to deal with it, you know. The future of poetry, I don't know it at all because, you know, 50 years from now, there's going to be another type of Jeffrey Santolo guy asking another guy like me the same question after I'm dead, like, you know, and so I don't know the future of it. I think right now, I think it's definitely heading towards a narrative-based thing. I think the popularity of performance poetry, which I'm not into at all, I don't really particularly care for slam poetry type stuff at all, or rap or stuff like that. It's just not my thing. I think that the more I'm in tune with my own writing on the paper, which is what I like more 10 million times better than doing readings, the more I can see the other writers that are the same way, that number is growing, especially in times of economic depression, when art and creativity grows. If you want it to explode right now, at this time, it's going to come out of the next now or the next few years because we're in such a depressed time and people have no other alternative but to create something, whether it be writing or music. It's fucked up out there. It ain't freaking easy. I've been freaking broke for 10 years now. It's fucked up. People are fucking starving. Right. So, you know, I'm not going to start preaching, but, like, you know, I think, like, creativity comes out of that.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
So, I mean, I guess that's the best way I can answer that because I don't know the future of it. Maybe someone will be copying Rob Plath like people did Bukowski. Maybe he'll be doing it to me or Rebecca Schmader or whoever, or John Dorsey. Maybe people will be copying them one day. You know, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot of great voices out there, yourself, John Dorsey. I mean, I could just go on and on here. You got a caller there, or?
Nah, man, we're down to 5 minutes, so.
Oh, down to 5 minutes, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
Sometimes
well,
we just don't get callers.
The host doesn't get, yeah. Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, with this, especially with the state of the environment right now, I mean, there's that great quote from a movie, The Third Man, classic film noir, where they said there was 500 years of peace in Switzerland, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock, right? But under the Borgias in Italy, where they had murder and strife, they produced Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci. So what I'm trying to say here is out of conflict, out of troubled time does come great art. And you're right. I think that I'm just trying to see. My biggest question by posing that to you is I feel that it's time for somehow, some way for us to kind of, I still feel that we're still under the shadow of the Beats. And we got to kind
of. I don't think we're really under the shadow of them. As like as much as you think we are, is because they're so close to us in time. If you were alive then, you probably would have said, "Oh man, we're still under the shadow of Henry Miller," you know, or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, we got a there's a collar.
I mean, you know, they were eclectic. They did it. They were the ones who introduced, you know, Hinduism. They brought in the Buddhism aspect. They brought in a lot of these types.
Hey, we
of
got a collar. I got a collar.
Yeah, bring them on.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, Frank Reardon.
Hello, Franklin Metropolis.
Hello, hello. I just wanted to tell you, you've actually sparked some pretty good conversation between my wife and myself just listening to you describe your art and your aesthetic, if you will. I'm not even going to bring up the fact that you're trying to trash talk about Henry Miller on the show.
I am not. I love Henry Miller.
Yeah, you better. You better. But I just wanted to ask you, man, to be honest with you, like I hear a lot of times, and this is something I've noticed with you a lot, is you talk about the difference between the older poet and the younger poet a lot in your writing. And you being a person that's only 38 years old, I'm just curious as to, like, I don't know, do you think that you're one of those unique cases in the writing world where you've blossomed into what you call a mature poet earlier than some other poets would do?
No. When I say the older poet and the young poet is myself. This is an ongoing struggle with myself for the most part. The original poem that I wrote about the guy screaming about his chapbook and fame was about me when I first published my first chapbook years ago. Do I think I'm a mature poet now? I don't think I'll be a mature poet when I'm 70.
Yeah.
I think I'll always keep growing. I think at, like, this junction of my life, especially being trapped for 3 years in a room, I've grown a lot of wisdom as opposed to my former self. So when I write about the young poet a lot, I'm usually, you know, that's usually that voice going, hey, man, let's still do this fucked up shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I see that, like, you're talking about it, and I do see that a lot of that is about yourself, and I was just curious as to what you think, what sort of attributes that you gained from being the younger poet as opposed to being the older poet, what sort of attributes that you gained to help you, I don't know, reconcile some of the differences between the two?
A lot of, to be honest with you, like, meditation, man, a lot of thought, a lot of quitting drinking, a lot of, not completely, but, you know, it took a lot to bring, and I try to keep parts of myself, my older self, my younger self, you know, every day I try to live, try to remember parts of myself. Am I answering your question?
No, you are, definitely. Yeah, please.
It's very important for me to, grow from the person that I was, and I'll say the same thing 10 years about me, like, oh, that 30-year-old douche, like, you know, it's a point to grow, but I feel as I've become more of a stable mind now. I don't have, like, 14 different directions in my brain dragging me in different ways. I'm more settled now. I mean, I think all that, like, philosophizing when I was younger and studying that in college and drinking and doing mad insane and having a big, huge ego really fucked my head up, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm not a drab or boring now. I'm just more wiser and, you know, picky.
Oh, yeah.
But I use, so.
I mean, I see a difference. I see a huge difference in interstate chokehold and where you're at now. I do. And I just wanted to tell you, as one person that is out here reading what you're doing, man, I appreciate the fuck out of it. So thank you for giving me the time to ask you a couple questions.
Thank you, Frankie.
Word up.
Very good. What kind of time we got, Frank?
We are done, but we're in...
we are done.
We're in the back hole. We're in the archive now, so...
All right.
I'm going to...
All right, well, kind of pleasure.
Thank you for taking your time, sir.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It was my pleasure, and keep writing.
You too, man. All right.
All right.
Well, that was Jeffrey Santolo interviewing me, your host. I have a new book coming out soon. I don't know the exact time. It is called The Nirvana Haymaker from Neoplasis Press. I almost forgot my fucking own book for a second. And then next year I have a book from called Blood Music from Punk Hostage Press. Next week our guest is going to be Rob Plath. He'll be discussing his new book, Death is Dead. And today actually was the start of season 2. So, what the fuck ever.